It has now been 6 months since the pandemic began, and 6 months since I began this show as a way of learning myself about the world that we have ended up in. This is the 47th episode of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report, and as you can hear from Governor Ralph Northam, we're still at risk of wider outbreaks.
We continue to see roughly 1,000 new cases a day statewide.
In today's show, highlights from the September 15th, 2020 press conference by Governor Ralph Northam. We'll also hear from a local leader as part of the Center for Nonprofit Excellence's Hope and Resiliency Conversation Series.
You know, it has been quite the journey for all of us. And a friend of mine hit their analogy was, it's like we got hit in the head with a rock. And now we're standing up, we're still dazed, there's still blood coming down into our eyes, but at least we're standing.
I'm your host, Sean Tubbs, and I thank you for listening to yet another episode of this program, and thank you for supporting me on Patreon and in Substack. For posterity, let's get a little information about today. A mass testing event at the Fluvanna Women's Correctional Facility has led to the biggest one-day rise in that county since the pandemic began. The Thomas Jefferson Health District reported 41 cases this morning. According to a statement from Catherine Goodman at the Thomas Jefferson Health District, the uptick in Fluvanna County cases is due to point prevalence testing done at the Fluvanna Women's Correctional Facility. Overall, the district reported 60 cases today, with 12 from Charlottesville and 5 from Albemarle. Statewide, there are another 845 cases of COVID-19 in the Commonwealth, as reported by the Virginia Department of Health this morning. The statewide 7-day average for positive tests has dropped to 6.9% today, from 7.1% yesterday. UVA reported another 4 cases yesterday, and their COVID tracker now states that 11% of quarantine rooms are in use, up from 8% the day before. The total at UVA since August 17th is 373 positive cases, 325 of which are students. On September 15th, 2020, Governor Ralph Northam began his press conference with an overview of where things are 6 months into the COVID-19 pandemic.
Our percent positivity is at 6.8%. Which has been decreasing for 12 days now, and that is good news. Previously, we had concerns about increased cases and positivity in the eastern part of Virginia, so we added some restrictions in Hampton Roads, as you know, and it looks as if that plan worked quite well.
Those restrictions in the eastern region included early closings for restaurants, and they were ended after 2.5 weeks of declining positive test rates.
We, however, continue to keep an eye on some other regions in Virginia. For example, Southwest Virginia is seeing more new cases per day on average, 229, than any other region in our state, even Northern Virginia, which is home to a lot more people living closer together. Since Southwest Virginia has fewer people and fewer hospitals with fewer ICU beds and capabilities, this continues to be concerning to us. The percent positivity in Southwest Virginia is 8.1%. This has been decreasing in recent days, as you can see, but is the highest in the state right now, although the central region is not far behind.
Northam urged people to continue following physical and social distancing guidelines and to wear their masks indoors. He also announced that more than 500,000 people have downloaded the COVID-Wise tracking app.
We estimate that's around 12% of Virginians between ages 18 and 65. If you haven't downloaded the app, please do so.
Just over 6 months ago, restaurants were still open and people still moved about normally. Now, things are very different, and many remain out of work with the economic slowdown. That's had social effects.
We all know we have more people unemployed, more people who need assistance with rent, with food, and with their utility bills. Earlier this summer, the State Corporation Commission ordered a moratorium on utility disconnections early in the pandemic, and I really appreciate that. This has helped us protect public health and keep families safer at home.
The State Corporation Commission has agreed to extend a moratorium on utility cutoffs through October 5th. The moratorium had been set to expire at midnight, 6 months after it was first issued. In a release, the SCC indicated there would be no further extension. The statement reads that the mounting costs of unpaid bills must eventually be paid, either by the customers in arrears or by other customers who themselves may be struggling to pay their bills. The statement goes on to say that only the General Assembly can fix the issue. Governor Northam said that's on the way.
This will give the General Assembly the time that they need to finalize the budget and address this very important issue. The budget I sent to the legislature includes a moratorium on utility disconnections, a repayment plan structure, and a debt forgiveness program.
Another area disrupted by the pandemic is the election. Turnout goes up sharply during presidential elections, and this year is certainly an important one, and an unusual one.
So far, the Department of Elections has received 790,000 requests for absentee ballots by mail. They'll start sending out these ballots this Friday, the 18th of September. For comparison, 4 years ago, 566,000 total votes were cast absentee and only half by mail. So now, 7 weeks before Election Day, we have already surpassed absentee demands from 4 years ago. We know that that demand will continue to go up.
Anyone can vote absentee this year, either by mail or in-person early voting. Early voting begins this Saturday and runs through November 3rd. It could be a bumpy ride.
Everyone should be prepared to wait a few days to know the results of the presidential election as states count unprecedented numbers of mail-in votes. It's important to ensure that all votes are counted and for the process to work. It's better to get an accurate count than a fast one.
Northam also used his September 15th briefing to draw awareness to suicide prevention. Many of us know people who were no longer with us 6 months into the pandemic. For me, one of them was a veteran of the Second Iraq War.
Every day, we lose 17 veterans to suicide in this country. The 2017 data from Virginia Department of Health shows that 231 veterans died by suicide right here in Virginia. This represents approximately 21% of total suicide deaths that year. One suicide, as I said, is one too many. Virginia now has more than 725,000 veterans. As a veteran and an Army doctor, I treated wounded soldiers. I saw firsthand the strength and courage of our men and women in uniform. It's not weakness to ask for help. If you or someone you know is having a difficult time or needs immediate help, please call this number, 1-800-273-8255. I'll repeat that, 1-800-273-8255. This is the number for both the Military Crisis Line and our Veterans Crisis Line.
On September 15th, the Virginia Department of Health reported an additional 96 deaths for a total of 2,883. That number increased to 2,943 on September 16th. At the press conference, Health Commissioner Norm Oliver cautioned against reading too much into those one-day totals.
Occasionally there will be a spike, as we have in this number, and that just represents catching up with death certificates, which come in much later than what we get from the hospitals. If you look at a different graph, which is the deaths recorded by the date of death, you'll get a much better picture of the course of the disease. You'll see that we had a peak earlier in the year, and it's been leveled off in the low teens for many, many weeks now.
Earlier this summer, Northam and the governors of several states announced they would band together to purchase an alternative kind of COVID-19 testing kits to speed up results and expand capacity. At the September 15th press conference, Kate Masters of the Virginia Mercury followed up on antigen tests.
Maryland announced last week that it had completed its order of antigen tests through the Rockefeller Foundation. Can you give us a status update on Virginia's order and whether there's been thought to how those tests would be deployed?
Yes, thank you. Dan, I may let you address. I continue to talk weekly, sometimes more frequently, to our fellow governors. And just before Dan comes up, Dr. Carey, there are about 10 states in that compact now, and we're, as a general, working together and ready to communicate with the manufacturers and ready to purchase when they're available to us. Dan, if you want to elaborate on that.
Dan Carey is Virginia's health secretary.
Thank you, Governor. Yes, we are working very closely as part of Virginia's participation in the multi-state collaboration. We are doing our final stages of our analysis. The original purpose is, one, to make sure that Virginia and the other states band together and get the best prices for point-of-care antigen-type testing, but also because manufacturing hasn't risen to meet the demand, we're trying to give that clear signal to the marketplace to manufacture those. And Maryland did indeed put an order for 250,000 of one type of the test, the Becton-Dickinson test. We in Virginia are assessing and have assessed the types of point-of-care machines that are here. And we are, to answer the second point of your question, you asked how will we prioritize and where to send those tests. So our priorities remain the care of the most vulnerable. So we're looking at what the needs are of our assisted living facilities, our senior care centers, our federally qualified health centers, and our free clinics and the like, and other congregate settings to see where their testing supply needs are and how we might assist them further. So we're in the latter part of our analysis, and we're almost to the point, but have not yet put the recommendation to the governor to make that final step. But we are very much engaged on a multiple times per week with the Rockefeller Foundation and the multi-state collaborative.
Let's hear another question from Kate Masters.
Is really just about Virginia's numbers. And, you know, when you look at the COVID dashboard, we're seeing that new cases are on average around 1,000 new cases a day. Our percent positivity is actually 7% as of today. But when you look at neighboring states like Maryland and North Carolina, that positivity rate is, you know, 5% or under. So, I mean, for you, are Virginia's numbers acceptable at this point?
Kate, I appreciate the question. And, you know, I would make the point to Virginians, we want to be leaders. I want to be leaders. We want to be the best in everything. And so, yes, when I see neighboring states at 5 and we're at 6.5 or 7, that bothers me. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Kate, you know, we're doing, I think, all the right things with PPE, with testing, with tracing, but it's the behavior that's the challenge. And that's up to Virginians. And if we can, despite what's going on in Washington, and I'm not going to touch that anymore, but despite what's going on in Washington, if we can do what we know works, and that is wear facial protection, that's not too much to ask, and keep our social distancing, that's not a whole lot to ask, and wash our hands frequently, then we can get our numbers even lower than 5. And it's that behavior. It's that behavior that will put this pandemic behind us. Not testing, not tracing, not PPE, but behavior. And that's what we need to continue to emphasize to Virginians and to Americans, that it's the behavior that will get this health crisis behind us, and then we'll be able to move on, get our economy back up and running, get our children back in school, all of the things that we knew as normal prior to COVID-19.
Now, since the beginning of the pandemic, Governor Northam has mostly refrained from direct critique of the federal government and the federal administration. But a reporter followed up on that comment that you just heard about Northam not wanting to touch what's happening in Washington. Let's hear the question and conclude this section with this long answer.
Governor, I know you said you were maybe not going to touch what's going on in Washington, but I wondered if, as a doctor, you wanted to address what President Trump said about downplaying the risks of the of COVID early on?
Well, Laura, let me make a couple points, and I appreciate the question, but you know, I've said all along that we are fighting a biological war. Our first case in Virginia was on March 7th, believe it or not, a half a year ago. And we began fighting this war, and when I say we as the Commonwealth of Virginia, and also we as governors, without the supplies that we needed. And from the beginning, I think it's the governors have really taken a responsible leadership position in being upfront with our constituents, talking about the science of this virus as we know it, the things that work to keep the virus under control. And unfortunately, what has happened is it's become political. Just to look at the couple of rallies that have taken place with the president in the past couple of days, rallies that are indoors where people are congregating close together, no facial protection or very minimal use of facial protection. And it just goes against the science and the grain of what we're trying to do as Americans and what we're trying to do as states. And so that's to me frustrating, and it's also regrettable. And as I mentioned earlier, this our ability to get this pandemic under control, it's in our hands, and it's all about our behavior, and it's all about, you know, doing the right thing and following the science. And so when we have a president that ignores the science, number one, and then goes against what even his consultants are telling him, you know, to do, it's just defeating the purpose, and it's very frustrating. The other point I would make, Laura, and I certainly don't mean to be political, but I say this as a veteran, and I also say it as a doctor who took care of a lot of wounded soldiers during the Gulf War, and soldiers who have had traumatic brain injuries from explosive devices. A lot of them have had loss of limbs. A lot of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I consider them as heroes. I consider them the reason that I'm able to stand behind this microphone and as a Virginian and as American speak freely. And when we talk about the suicide rate of veterans, which is 17 per day in this country, when we have the leader of our country referring to people like me and other men and women who have worn the uniform and some who have ultimately paid the sacrifice of death to refer to them as losers and suckers, it just turns my stomach. And so, as an American, as a Virginian, I have trouble looking up to a leader. I have trouble respecting a leader that refers to my fellow veterans in that manner. And so, as I've said all along, and one of the reasons that I want to make this election as secure as we can to make sure that every vote counts, this is why we have elections. And I encourage everybody, not just in Virginia, but everybody in this country, to exercise their right on November the 3rd or prior to then and make sure that their vote counts.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a press conference by Governor Ralph Northam from September 15th, 2020. That's the 6-month anniversary of the beginning of this podcast. That you have been listening to, hopefully since the beginning, but if not, go back and listen and hear this archive of what we've been through and what the community has been going through all this time. You'll also be able to hear how I decided some point along this journey to go ahead and become an independent reporter again, bringing you as much content as I can about the world around me. You can support that by going to Patreon and hopefully offering a monthly subscription. Or you can subscribe to the Community Engagement Newsletter, which has a lot of other things on it as well. My goal here is to bring you information about as much as I can about the community around me now and into the future. This pandemic has certainly woken me up in a lot of ways, and I'm here to hopefully continue to dream of a better world along with you and make it happen. Let's get back to the program. The COVID-19 pandemic began 6 months ago, and since then, many people's lives have been transformed due to the uncertainty, the economic slowdown, or they have had to stay within lockdown to avoid getting the virus. The Center for Nonprofit Excellence has been recording a series of conversations with area leaders on hope and resilience. Rich Schuyler is the Dean of Community Self-Sufficiency Programs at Piedmont Virginia Community College. He's interviewed here by Lee Catlin.
My name is Lee Catlin. I'm a board member for the Center for Nonprofit Excellence, or CNE, and I'm really delighted to be welcoming Rich Schuyler to our series on conversations on hope and resilience. Rich and I have known each other in many different capacities for many years, and the one thing that has always been a constant with my relationship with Rich is that he is always working really hard to make things better for some of the most vulnerable in our community. So thank you for your efforts on our behalf, Rich, and thank you for being here with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Usually people who've known me for a long time really don't want to, you know, record me.
Real quick, in a minute or two, you could catch our audience up with exactly what you're working on in these days.
Yeah, so I'm a dean at Piedmont Virginia Community College, and we're focused on finding folks who've been left behind in our economy and connecting them to jobs that pay family-sustaining wages, as well as the training and supports they need to get and keep those jobs. And so it really is focusing on the people who are really struggling to climb the economic ladder, but just need a little bit of guidance doing so.
Well, it's hard to think of a better person to be talking to at this moment in time. And I think what we wanted to maybe start our conversation with, Ridge, is we've been having these conversations since March. And in the early conversations, it was much more focused on how people stay resilient and stay strong and courageous during what at that point we thought was a defined shorter-term crisis situation. We're now in the place where it feels a longer term, more a marathon than a sprint. So talk to us a little bit about your journey as things have moved into the fall and how you are sustaining your energy and your self-care and your well-being at a time when there is just continued uncertainty without a defined endpoint in mind.
You know, it has been quite the journey for all of us. And a friend of mine hit their analogy was, it's like we got hit in the head with a rock and now we're standing up. We're still dazed. There's still blood coming down into our eyes, but at least we're standing. And at least we can start looking forward and seeing what's happening, but we're still dazed. And that is kind of how I feel, is that, we're up off the ground. We've dusted ourselves off, but the future is still a little bit hazy. And back months ago, we used terms like post-pandemic. And to your point, it was like there was going to be some date by which the pandemic would be over and all things would go back to normal. And that is not the way this is going to unfold. And the pandemic itself is a crisis that is going to drag on, but the pandemic also highlighted inequities in our society that also are creating a drag that we have to figure out how to unload. And it's going to require a lot of intentional effort. And so I spend a lot of my time trying to figure out what can I do to help us address not just the crisis of the moment, but the long-term impacts of the pandemic and the inequities that it has really highlighted in our community. And just on how I manage to get up every day and move forward every day, I mean, really, I am very, very blessed that I have a job that gives me purpose. And so I can take my concern and my anxiety and channel it into what I hope to be something productive. And that really is helpful to keep on going, is to say, well, I know why I'm putting one foot in front of the other, because it hopefully will make a difference in somebody's life.
I appreciate that sense of purpose and kind of that ability to deal with the individual. You mentioned also community several times, which I think is really important, because this is hitting at so many levels, but certainly there's a community resilience aspect to it. When you think of the Charlottesville, Albemarle County region, our shared community, what do you see in terms of being important for community level resilience in a situation like this?
Yep. Well, you know, I think it starts with the resilience of individuals that then collectively create a community resilience made more difficult by the lack of social interaction, which is so key to all of us as just as human beings. But each individual, each family has had to learn resilience in order to weather the storm. And so, you know, the first order of business is we got to help families be resilient, and a community can help do that by providing assistance in times of need. You know, we just as one example at Network to Work, we had a donor that gave us $50,000 worth of food cards in $50 increments, and we were able to identify 882 people and hand them all out on one day at the Jefferson School through the generosity of one donor who was both trying to help families that were struggling to feed themselves following the acute loss of a job, but also trying to help those restaurants that were struggling to survive because their doors were closed. And so this donor said, you know, I'm going to help both that small restaurant owner and the families that are struggling in order to survive. And we were lucky to be in the middle of that, trying to help distribute those cards. And that is an example of community resilience, where people are doing whatever they can to help their friends and neighbors who aren't their friends. They've never met them, but they know that there are others who are struggling. And so, you know, folks willing to lend a hand, which is often what we see in times of crisis, but we've certainly seen it here in Charlottesville.
I love that story. I love the way people are looking to be intentional with their help and trying to work across the equations as much as they possibly can. Great
Absolutely.
Story. This is probably tough to maybe narrow this down to one, but when you think about the most significant challenges that are out there in terms of people staying healthy, people staying hopeful, people staying resilient, what do you see as the biggest challenge or top several challenges to our ability to do that?
So I actually think that hope rises to the top. I think the biggest challenge we face is people feeling hopeless. Hopeless in the face of the pandemic, hopeless in the face of racial inequity that has been as, you know, the original sin of America, you know, for 400 years. And at some point, you can just say, to heck with it. It's just too much. I can't deal with it anymore. And what we need to do is focus on hopefulness, on the fact that things can change. It's hard and slow, but we've got to maintain that thread of hope in order to muscle through. And I think that looking at what the community has done should give us hope. As much as August 12th kicked us in the gut, what happened after August 12th, the unity days, the community coming together, the recognition that maybe we shouldn't have Confederate statues that you have to pass by in order to get justice at a courthouse in our town. These things should give us hope that we see and hear, and we will chip away at the inequities that seem that can seem overwhelming, but know that people are being heard and that actions are being taken that start to dismantle some of those inequities that can seemingly overwhelm us.
Thank you. I think that kind of hand in hand with hopelessness in the face of uncertainty can be fearfulness as well. So as a leader in the community, both professionally and personally and in so many different arenas, Ridge, how do you, for yourself and for those that you work with, really kind of embrace bravery as opposed to fearfulness in leading in these times? Because there are some, the issues that you mentioned, the things that are before us, they require a lot of courage. How do you tap into bravery instead of fear as a leader?
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I tap into reserves that were given to me by my mom, who in the 1960s found herself as a single parent raising four boys. She was denied jobs because she had children back when that was legal. Employers would just say, "We're not going to hire you because you'll be home with your sick children." And she was brave in the face of all that adversity. And it was because she had to be. She had no choice but to be brave. And I think that's really the wellspring, is we don't have a choice but to stare down our fear and to march forward and draw strength from our family and our friends, and know the purpose for which we are living. And the potential that we have as human beings, which every one of us has, sometimes it can get lost to you in the haze of the crisis of the moment. But I think you need to tap into what is it that makes you special, and what is it that gives you potential in this world? And it may be, you know, raising your children. It may be being the best diesel mechanic that you can be. It may be being a good son to a mother or brother to a sister. But identifying that thing that makes you important and hanging on to that in the face of all that assails you, I think is the key. And that is what my mom taught me, all, you know, 5 feet of her. She always was smiling, and she always looked on the bright side because she didn't have a choice.
I love that you use the family example, that you talk about your mother, because I think at a time when the issues seem so big and so overwhelming, it's like, how can I be a hero in these times? And being a hero very often is just getting up that day and doing what you have to do for the people who are depending on you. So great.
Absolutely.
Story. You know, I think, Ridge, one of the things that we're facing in these times is that their fearfulness and hopelessness can become anger and can become bitterness and antagonism. So, you know, we see this very passionate dialogue and divide out there. It causes people to get tribal and take sides. How do you stay compassionate? How do you stay open-minded and compassionate towards people in a time when it's very easy to say, how can people be like that?
Yep. I mean, it's both your head and your heart. I mean, your heart has to be open and empathetic, and it is putting yourself in somebody else's shoes to understand why they are reacting the way they do, because all of us have a common sense of humanity that binds us. And a lot of that humanity is, you know, we're trying to provide for ourselves and our families. We're trying to exercise dominion over our lives. And I can understand, if I open my heart, why people are feeling like they don't have that control and they can't provide for their families. So part of it is the heart. The other part is the head, which always usually kind of often lags behind the heart, for better or for worse. But I know in my head that if I attack somebody because I don't like their views, they're going to get in a defensive posture. And people who are in a defensive posture don't move. And so you cannot advance your objectives if you are making people defensive. And so it just is an exercise in futility to let anger guide your efforts to change what's happening in front of you. It's understandable that anger comes from a very real place. It's often anger that has been sadly earned by a society that may have kicked you to the curb and your family to the curb and your family before that. But we're not going to get where we need to go if we don't open our hearts and understand with our heads that yelling at people is not going to change how they feel, that we have to understand where they're coming from and find the common ground and say, what is it that we share as human beings that we can work on together? And I think if we can get to that place, hard and in partisan and tribal times, but we've got to get to that place or else we're just never going to make progress.
Rich, as my closing question to you, I think that you have had a really unique opportunity in your work through the years. You work with the highest levels of people in the city, in the county, in the business world, in UVA, all our institutional partners. And you've had a chance to see a lot of leaders at the highest level and all throughout organizations at work. When you reflect on the times we're in and kind of what you have seen being effective in leadership in your life, what do you think are the most important quality or top couple of qualities that we need from our leaders at this moment?
I mean, I do think it going back to my previous question, I mean, I think we have to understand where our employees, our community members, where people are coming from, truly understand what is motivating people and tapping into that part of us that is good, which we all have. It is a unique leader who can identify that goodness in people that they may not even see in themselves and lift it up. And that is a quality employer, that is a quality leader of a community, is to see the good in other people and raise it up when they can't even see it in themselves. And I see it across not just, you know, locally, but, you know, I had the benefit of working for 10 years on Capitol Hill, and I was the chief policy advisor for United States Senator, and I saw that there too. There were the ones who were in it for the gratification they got by getting a certain number of votes, and there were others who were in it to actually improve the lives of fellow Americans. And the ones who were the most successful over time were the ones who really were trying to benefit the lives of Americans. And I see that at every level of leadership, is identifying what is good and raising it up.
Well, that's a great place to end. I appreciate your time, Rich. Thank you so much. And again, on a personal note, I really appreciate what I have seen you do for our community for low these many years. So thank you and good luck and stay strong and healthy.
Thank you. You as well. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the latest in a series of conversations by the Center for Nonprofit Excellence on hope and resilience. You listened to Ridge Schuyler, the Dean of Community Self-Sufficiency Programs at Piedmont Virginia Community College. And that's it for this installment of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report. We'll be back at a later date with more. And I would really like to offer you up the chance to submit anything that you would like to this program. One thing that I don't think this program has done a good job of is bringing stories of people's changed lives. That's something I'd like to begin to restore to a lot of the content that I'm trying to provide through my Town Crier Productions, which is the production company that you are all here to listen to. I'm Sean Tubbs, the host of this program and the Charlottesville Community Engagement Newsletter and Newscast, and a lot of other programs to come in the future. But for now, I really would like to hear your story. please send me a note to wordcast@gmail.com if you'd like to work through or get in touch with me somehow. I'm here to hopefully tell your story as we tell the community's stories. Thanks for listening, and have a good day and stay safe out there.